Hi, I'm Matt Payne, and welcome to 20th Century Revolutions. Episode 2.23, The Young Turk Revolution. Well, boys and girls, ladies and gents, we have made it. The Young Turk Revolution. Wow. Feels good to be here, doesn't it? I know that I am pretty dang excited, but one quick announcement before we dive in is that I will be taking a short break for a few weeks after today's episode. But when we get back, we will be diving straight into the craziness that is the post-revolutionary Second Constitutional Era. It's going to be a lot of fun when we get back, but before we do, today is a big day. So let's dive on into this thing. On December the 15th, 1907, diplomats representing the six great powers, Great Britain, Austria-Hungary, Russia, Italy, Germany, and France, issued a joint letter to Sultan Abdulhamid and his government at the Sublime Porte, demanding enhanced powers for the foreign representatives operating in Ottoman Macedonia, so that further reforms could be carried out in the region, all in order to ensure the protection of Christian minorities. The context for this great power demand to the Ottoman government was that the imperial decree sanctioning Great Britain to operate in Macedonia was set to expire at the end of 1907. So, Great Britain decided to take the opportunity to assert their influence in the Ottoman Balkans, as the Balkans had recently come to be dominated by Russia and Austria-Hungary in the years following the Ilinden Uprising and the subsequent Mersteg Agreement. The Mersteg Agreement had originally been issued in 1903 in response to the violent chaos unleashed during the Ilinden Uprising. This agreement was hashed out between Tsar Nicholas II of Russia and Emperor Franz Joseph of Austria, and the Mersteg program placed great power representatives throughout the Macedonian provinces in an attempt to reassert law and order in the region. However, as we have discussed, this effort was largely unsuccessful, and the Macedonian struggle only became more bitter in the years following the Ilinden Uprising, and the presence of these arrogant and paternalistic European civil servants simply had the effect of creating even more resentment amongst the Muslim populations of Macedonia. As the imperial decrees allowing for the presence of British officials in Macedonia were coming to an end, the British government began to reconsider their weakened position in Macedonia, and new calls were made in the Parliament for British intervention into the region. This shift in British policy towards a more interventionist stance in Ottoman Macedonia would bring the British newly in line with the Russian Empire, as the Russians also had a renewed interest in the Ottoman Balkans in the years following the disastrous Russo-Japanese War and the Russian Revolution of 1905 that had been precipitated by the Russian loss to the Japanese. When it was issued, the Mersteg Agreement of 1903 made the Austrian position in the Balkans more powerful, which the Russians had allowed to happen since their focus at that time had been on expanding their borders eastward into Manchuria, deciding to pause their encroachment on the decaying Ottoman Empire in order to encroach on the decaying Qing Chinese Empire. But then, when the Japanese challenged Russian expansion into the Far East and then stomped all over the Russians in the Russo-Japanese War, the Russian Far East adventure came to an abrupt end, and the Russian Tsar was humiliated both at home and in the foreign press. The disaster of the Russo-Japanese War led the Russians to become interested once more in expanding their influence in the Ottoman Balkans. So, as the British expressed their own renewed interest in the area in late 1907, the Russians decided to team up with the British in order to challenge Austrian hegemony in Macedonia. At first, this rift opening up between Austria-Hungary and Russia would be expressed through competing plans to build railroads in the Ottoman Balkans. As the Austrians were already in the process of negotiating with the Ottoman government for the Austrians to construct a railway to Salonika that would allow them to access the Adriatic Sea. And now that the Russians were newly interested in Macedonia, they saw this as a breach of the Maersteg Agreement. And so the Russians began to work with the British to put a stop to Austrian plans in Macedonia. As the British began to assert their hegemony in the Ottoman Balkans, the British press and the members of the House of Commons began to whip up anti-Turkish sentiment that had not been seen since the days of William Gladstone and the Bulgarian horrors. So, with British public opinion turning against the Turk once more, British Foreign Secretary Sir Edward Grey began making Gladstonian statements demanding that the Ottomans be forced to appoint a governor of Macedonia approved of by the great powers. A portion of this statement reads as follows. Quote, "If a Turkish governor were appointed for a fixed term of years, a man whose character and capacity were accepted and recognized by the powers, and if he had a free and willing hand and his position were secure, I believe that the whole Macedonian question might be solved. I said a Turkish governor whose character and capacity were recognized and accepted by the powers. I mean a governor appointed with the consent of the powers, irremovable without their consent, and secure in his appointment for a term of years." Now, this statement from Sir Edward Grey was a bigger deal than you might initially think. The top diplomat in the British government was stating that the Ottomans would have to submit their choice of a governor for their own province in Macedonia to the great powers for approval. Then, this governor could only be dismissed if the great powers all consented to the governor's removal. In short, this was a major challenge to Ottoman sovereignty in Macedonia. And this demand was, in fact, nearly the exact same demand that had been made by the great powers 30 years earlier in 1876 amidst the Great Eastern Crisis. And it was this very demand in 1876 that the Ottomans would have to submit their choice of regional leaders for approval by the great powers that the Ottoman administration had felt they could not accept under any circumstance. This refusal of the Ottomans had then led the Russians to invade Ottoman Bulgaria, which launched the Russo-Turkish War of 1877-78. This Russian invasion had dismembered Ottoman Europe. And as a result of the war, the Ottomans had lost control of Serbia, Romania, Montenegro, Bulgaria, Bosnia-Herzegovina, Egypt, and Cyprus. So, in short, this demand made by Sir Edward Grey that the Ottomans submit their choice of governor for Macedonia for approval by the great powers was never going to be accepted by the Ottoman administration. And in response to the declaration, Abdulhamid simply renewed the imperial decree that had previously been in place. And this decree reestablished the mandates of British agents in Macedonia. This renewal was made in an effort to maintain the status quo and to prevent the emergence of a joint British-Russian reform project in Macedonia. The rapprochement developing between the Russians and the British, who had been imperial rivals for over a century, would become extremely important for the future course of world history, as it would eventually mature into the British-Russian-French Entente that would form the dividing lines of World War I. But in the immediate future for the Ottomans, the development of a working agreement between the Russians and the British with regard to the future of Macedonia would be absolutely disastrous for the future of Ottoman rule in Europe. Because as much as patriotic Ottomans hated the Maersteg Agreement of 1903, This Russian-Austrian program was relatively conservative in its aims, as the great power representatives in Macedonia still only held advisory roles, and Ottoman administrators had become real masters at evading these paternalistic European advisors through the tried-and-true method of promising you'll get to something and then stalling indefinitely. This new program being proposed by the British and the Russians, on the other hand, would be much more aggressively interventionist, with great power representatives now holding real executive power in the region. Even though the British and Russians were hoping to increase their influence in the Balkans and to allegedly improve the condition of religious minorities, this British-Russian joint program to demand further reforms in Macedonia would end up having the unintended effect of strengthening the position of the Committee of Union and Progress. And the diplomatic maneuvering on the part of the great powers in early 1908 would set the ball rolling towards the Young Turk Revolution. The CUP would make great hay out of the British-Russian scheming, and the Young Turks would rapidly step up their propaganda in the Balkans, spreading rumors that the great powers were about to annex Macedonia, and that the Russians planned to drive out all Ottoman Muslims from their ancestral homelands. This CUP propaganda campaign would prove extremely effective, and more Muslims would come to see the CUP as the only true defenders of Muslim rule in Macedonia. And in many ways, they were. In response to Sir Edward Grey's speech demanding a Macedonian governor approved of by the great powers, the CUP external organization under Ahmet Riza and Dr. Shakir issued the following statement. Quote, Macedonia's independence means the loss of half of the Ottoman Empire, and therefore its complete annihilation. As is known to our brothers, without Macedonia in between, Albania will naturally be lost. Since our border will have to retreat to the gates of Istanbul, the capital cannot remain in Istanbul. The removal of our capital from Europe to Asia would exclude us from being among the powers of Europe, and make us a second or even a third-class Asiatic power. If, heaven forfend, we lose Rumelia, then because of the vastness of Anatolia, the fact that people are dispersed throughout that area and the lack of railways, we would need more than 6 months to transport troops to a given point. Thus, Ottoman sovereignty will be reduced to the level of Iranian power. Since the Macedonian question is the question of the existence of the Turks, we presume that for a sincere government it should be preferable to take the chance of a great war instead of losing Macedonia and Rumelia. Alas, what can we expect from this filthy government? Because today governments are controlled by parliaments, and the life of the individual has gained enormous importance. No parliament would grant an authorization to a government for the killing of 40 or 50,000 Europeans. In this statement, the CUP was making their position very clear. The loss of Macedonia would set off a chain of events that would end in the final destruction of the Ottoman Empire. The CUP was turning the Macedonian question into the question of Ottoman survival. And therefore, any and all measures were warranted if those measures were taken in order to stave off Macedonian annexation or independence. The proclamations of the CUP would strike a chord with the Muslim populations of Macedonia and Albania, and the Unionist would become increasingly popular throughout the Balkans. The CUP internal organization under the leadership of the revolutionary mailman Talat had also begun to formulate a plan for how best to respond to this existential threat of a joint British-Russian program for Macedonia. The overall plan was to launch their long-awaited assassination campaign of notorious Ottoman officials, who maintained the autocratic regime of Sultan Abdulhamid. These assassinations, carried out by self-sacrificing fedayi, were meant to, quote, make known the strong presence of the CUP in Macedonia. Talat noted that the benefit of initiating isolated assassinations instead of a mass protest or mass revolt was that it would protect the vast majority of CUP members and prevent the Sultan from obliterating the CUP network. Essentially, public assassinations were meant to menace the Sultan without fully revealing the CUP, because coming fully out into the open too fast would make the organization vulnerable to Abdul Hamid's secret police. Then, as this assassination campaign was being initiated, CUP men in the army were ordered to begin organizing Muslim guerrilla bands. These bands were told to neutralize the Christian guerrilla bands in order to prevent the MRO and other Christian revolutionary groups from using a great power intervention in order to precipitate the annexation of Macedonia into Bulgaria, Greece, or Serbia. This neutralization of the Christian bands would be carried out either through offensive attacks or preferably through coming to some sort of agreement that would bring the Christian revolutionaries into a working alliance with the CUP. And while many of the leaders of these Christian bands also wanted a constitutionalist regime, so the CUP had more luck than you might initially think in bringing Macedonian Christians over to their side by striking deals with, offering protection for, and when necessary, threatening Christian communities and Christian guerrilla bands. The CUP spent the spring of 1908 making these necessary preparations for a joint action against the Sultan, so that by the summer of 1908, the Unionists felt ready to make their move. And you'll hear a lot of different stories surrounding these plans, and many junior officers would claim after the revolution that the plan had been roughly to launch their campaign against Abdul Hamid in late summer or early fall 1908. But the revolution would end up breaking out several months earlier than originally planned, because in June, the Russian Tsar Nicholas met with his uncle, the British King Edward, at the Estonian port city of Reval. The Reval meeting, as it would come to be known, was held as part of the ongoing negotiations to establish an entente between the British and Russian empires, which again would end up having earth-shattering consequences leading up to 1914. And though the Tsar and the King discussed many topics at Reval, including their concerns around the increasing power of the German Empire, they also spent a good deal of time discussing the future of Ottoman rule in the Balkans. The Reval meeting would set off every alarm bell possible amongst patriotic Ottoman Muslims, and in response to these talks at Reval, the CUP would use their now vast propaganda networks to spread the news that Tsar Nicholas and King Edward were hatching plans to tear their fatherland away from their empire. And though the Tsar and the King could not have predicted it, this great power scheming would end up being one step too far for the radicalized junior officers of the Third Army. And the single greatest effect of the negotiations at Reval was that the popularity of the CUP would skyrocket amongst Muslims living in the European territories of the Ottoman Empire, in Albania, Thrace, Macedonia, and Kosovo. Around the same time that the Reval meeting was being held in Russian Estonia, Sultan Abdul Hamid had begun to crack down on CUP activities in Macedonia. By June 1908, the CUP had dramatically grown in size, and the organization now numbered some 2,000 members. The increasingly vast network of CUP agents made it nearly impossible for the Unionists to continue operating as a secret organization, and it was only really a matter of time until the CUP would have to reveal themselves. But the always adroit Abdul Hamid decided that he needed to make the first move, and he initiated a large investigation into CUP activities. After this investigation, the secret police began arresting known CUP members, and the palace also ordered many military leaders suspected of working with the CUP to return to Istanbul, where they would be presumably redeployed to anywhere but Macedonia, or even potentially court-martialed. However, at this point, the Third Army in Monastir had been so thoroughly radicalized and the regiment was so teeming with officers who were also secretly members of the CUP that when the palace made this order for junior officers known to be seditious to return to the capital, higher-ranking officers in the Third Army just simply refused to carry out these orders. And instead, revolutionary officers were ordered to take their military bands into the Macedonian wilderness, allegedly in order to carry out actions against Christian guerrillas. But the real reason for these orders was that they offered an excuse for the revolutionary officers to not have to make the trip to Istanbul, where they were sure to be arrested or deported upon arrival. The Albanian officer, Adjutant Major Ahmed Niazi, would lead the first of these CUP bands, dubbed the CPU Resin National Battalion. In early July, in direct response to, number one, the Reval meeting between the Russians and the British, and number two, to the Sultan's generalized crackdown on CUP activities, Ahmed Niazi began to raid the military depot at the garrison in his hometown of Rezin, where he was stationed. Then, on July 3, 1908, the Rezin National Battalion, under the leadership of Ahmed Niazi, took their weapons seized from the military depot and headed into the mountains of Monastir. Major Ismail Enver quickly got wind of his comrade Niazi's defection, and so Enver would, just a couple of days later, lead his own CUP band into the mountains of Tikvesh, just to the northeast of Monastir. Around this same time, Adjutant Major Ayub Sabri, an Albanian who had helped Enver and Niazi to fold the Albanian guerrilla bands into the CUP, similarly led a CUP band into the mountains of Ohrid, to the west of Monastir. With these defections, a large section of the Third Army stationed in Monastir had now openly mutinied against Sultan Abdulhamid and had publicly declared their allegiance to the CUP. These mutinies of junior officers stationed in the Monastir province would mark the true beginning of the Young Turk Revolution. Even though the CUP had not ever officially marked July 3rd as their planned start date for the revolution, and even though Niazi's defection was in some ways a personal and spontaneous decision, the CUP had already begun actively preparing for this sort of mass defection of revolutionary officers for months now. And so when Niazi, Enver, and others began taking to the hills with their guerrilla bands, the CUP branches in Monastir and in Salonika were quite prepared to offer their support for the defecting officers, and they began sending out letters and telegrams to local leaders and to other CUP branches, spreading word of the mutiny amongst the population of Macedonia and amongst Ottoman officials, who were now given the choice to either submit to the will of the CUP or to remain loyal to the Sultan, and to face the consequences of either choice. As Niazi and Enver roamed the Macedonian countryside, the officers were most often welcomed with open arms by the village leaders and by the powerful landowners, who either were already secretly members of the CUB or had long been sympathetic to the patriotic cause. This was especially true in the Albanian towns and villages they passed through, and many Albanian notables quickly threw their support behind the revolutionary officers, because in many cases, these officers, like Niazi and Enver, had spent the last few months specifically cultivating the loyalty of these Albanian leaders by offering them protection from the Christian guerrilla bands. So, as word spread from the CUP headquarters in Monastir and Salonika, Enver, Niazi, and other band leaders would quickly grow their numbers as they recruited patriotic Muslims in the towns and villages they passed through, and as fellow army deserters and other volunteers sought them out in the wilderness in hopes of joining the cause. And then, even for the officers and rank-and-file soldiers who had not yet publicly defected to the CUP, these soldiers still largely refused to pursue the revolutionary battalions, even if they had been ordered to do so. Meaning that Niazi and Enver were, for the moment, given free rein to just roam the countryside and continue recruiting members into their revolutionary bands. However, The mutinies of Niazi and Enver would, of course, prompt Sultan Abdulhamid and his government to do everything they possibly could to repress the CUB. And the man who would be given the unenviable task of trying to halt the revolutionary wave sweeping through Macedonia was actually an Albanian, a top-tier general named Shimsi Pasha. Like many Muslims from the Balkans, Shimsi came from a mixed ethnic background, but he was widely recognized as and thought of himself as an Albanian. And as a trusted and high-ranking general, Shimsi represented the way in which Sultan Abdulhamid had worked hard during his reign to ensure the loyalty of Albanians through offering top positions to Albanian officers and bureaucrats. And in fact, the current Grand Vizier, Mehmed Ferid, was also an Albanian. General Shimsi Pasha had been born in the Ottoman province of Kosovo, today modern Kosovo, which was and still is predominantly inhabited by Albanian Muslims. Shimsi was a talented soldier known for his fierce loyalty to the Sultan. Unlike many of the revolutionary officers we have so far been talking about, like Enver, Niazi, and Mustafa Kemal, Shimsi was not a highly educated graduate of one of the elite military schools of the empire, meaning that Shimsi had methodically worked his way up to the rank of major general. And in this, Shimsi was emblematic of a larger division within the Ottoman military between less educated officers who had earned their rank through hard work and loyalty to the Sultan versus the highly educated graduates of the elite military academies, who were commonly known as the Mektebli officers. The vast majority of young Turk officers who would defect in 1908 were these sorts of highly educated Mektebli officers, while less educated officers, such as Shimsi Pasha, tended to remain loyal to the Sultan. Earmark this divide in the military, because it will become important later on once we get to the counter-revolution. In 1901, Shimsi Pasha had been appointed as the commander of the military division of the Kosovo region, which, by the way, for some geography, Kosovo lies to the north of the Monastir region where Enver and Niazi were currently forming their revolutionary battalions, meaning that Kosovo lies right along the Austrian border, and the Austrians were, of course, always meddling in Kosovo. Generally speaking, Shimsi had been tasked in 1901 with maintaining the loyalty of the Albanian populations of Kosovo, Albania, and Macedonia. And he had for a period of time done a decent job through essentially bribing local leaders. But then when Niazi and Enver defected in July of 1908, the loyalty of the Albanians quickly began to slip through the Sultan's fingers, and Shimsi was called on to put down the mutinies and to restore law and order to the region. When the CUP leaders got word that Shimsi Pasha was preparing to make a move against them, they began to debate the best way to counter this action. Because even though many soldiers and volunteers had joined the ranks of the CUP bands, Shimsi Pasha still commanded a large regiment of well-disciplined soldiers, and the CUP feared that their revolution would be squashed before it could even get started if they were forced to fight Shimsi's battalions head-on. So the CUP leaders opted for a different and more direct route, and they began organizing the assassination of Shimsi Pasha, deciding to just go ahead and go straight for the head of the dragon. As we talked about last week, a central part of the CUP strategy leading up to July 1908 was the recruitment of self-sacrificing volunteers who were tasked with assassinating notorious public officials in Salonika and Monastir. So it was actually pretty easy for the CUP to just order one of these already vetted fedayis to assassinate the Albanian general. Shimsi Pasha and his battalions would reach Monastir by train on July 7, 1908, just 5 days after the mutiny of Ahmed Niazi. Shimsi's plan was to head straight to Rezin in order to suppress Niasse's CUP National Battalion. However, the Major General first needed to send a few telegrams out to important Imperial administrators and to loyal Albanian notables in the area to alert them of his overall plan. But as Shimsi Pasha was leaving the post office on the very day of his arrival in Monastir, a CUP Fedayi and First Lieutenant in the Third Army pulled out a revolver and shot Shimsi Pasha, killing him instantly. Demonstrating the extent to which the CUP had now infiltrated and radicalized the Third Army, Shimsi Pasha's personal bodyguards had simply stepped aside and allowed the assassination of their general to take place, because they had already been brought over to the revolutionary camp by CUP agents in Monastir. And after the Pasha's death, these bodyguards would allow the CUP assassin to escape completely unharmed. Later that night, the CUP leaders in Monastir recruited two officers who were being dispatched by their commander down to Salonika, and the CUP ordered them to form another revolutionary band. So these officers would stop on their way to Salonika and defect to the revolution with hundreds of soldiers and volunteers and form the CUP Monastir Battalion. 4 days later, on July 11th, Major Enver Bey would send an ultimatum from his mountain hideout in Tikvesh to the Inspector General of Macedonia, demanding that the CUP agents and Third Army officers who had been arrested and shipped off to Istanbul be released within 48 hours. Enver ominously threatened that he would not take any responsibility for future developments should this ultimatum go unmet. Enver then followed this ultimatum to Abdulhamid's government up with a personal note sent out to his fellow officers and quote-unquote esteemed patriots in Macedonia, urging them to either join the revolutionary cause or to stay out of the way of the CUP. The Sultan and his government then scrambled a response and ordered the now dead Shimsi Pasha's son-in-law, a lieutenant and commander of the gendarme force in Monastir, to begin tracking down the revolutionary battalions roaming the countryside. However, what the Sultan did not realize is that Shimsi Pasha's son-in-law was already a member of the CUP branch in Monastir. So yeah, you can see where all this is going. And this gendarme commander would just stall as much as he could, meaning that the military regiments best positioned to put down the CUP bands were now under the command of a CUP agent, and therefore fully neutralized. Now understanding that the army forces in Macedonia could essentially not be relied upon to carry out his orders, the Sultan then began calling up first-class reservists stationed in Izmir, a port city that lies in Anatolia, just across the Aegean Sea from Salonika. But Dr. Nazim had already spent a ton of time in Izmir radicalizing these reservists. So the reservists refused to go to Salonika until they were paid their full salaries, which were months in arrears at this point. The Sultan quickly capitulated and paid these soldiers and officers. However, as these battalions of reservists trickled into Salonika throughout July, there were always CUP agents waiting for them at the Salonika harbor, and these CUP agents would give patriotic speeches to the soldiers, asking them to join the revolution. And, well, most of these reservists had already been radicalized by Dr. Nazim in Izmir, so they just joined up with the CUP upon their arrival in Salonika. And these reservists would either just refuse to march on the CUP National Battalions, or just as often, they would trek into the Macedonian wilderness, not in order to fight Enver and Niasse, but rather to join the heroes of liberty and to assist them in their great patriotic task of reestablishing constitutional rule. Scenes such as these witnessed in Monastir and in Salonika would repeat themselves in the cities all across Macedonia, Albania, and Kosovo, as whole battalions defected to the CUP cause, and as CUP Fedayi carried out assassinations of administrators and officers who remained loyal to the Sultan. These assassinations would menace other imperial governors who were more neutral to stay out of the way of the CUP or else. As the CUP was establishing de facto control over the civil administration in the Ottoman Balkans, Unionist leaders began posting demands in towns and cities throughout Macedonia, Albania, and Kosovo, calling upon the Sultan to reinstate the 1876 constitution of Midhat Pasha. Simultaneously, the Young Turks in exile, under the leadership of Ahmed Reza and Dr. Shakir, began issuing declarations to the European press, explaining that the revolution was being launched under the enlightened and liberal principles of liberty, equality, solidarity, and justice, self-consciously connecting their movement with the American and French revolutions. Along with these loftier claims about the character of the revolution, the CUP also declared that they refused any foreign intervention whatsoever, and that they were in no way representing the interests of any one of the great powers. This was an internal affair between the patriotic Ottomans of the CUP and of the Third Army, and the Sultan and his despotic and weak autocratic government. This propaganda campaign worked, and great power diplomats in Europe and consuls in the empire did not believe the Sultan's claim that the CUP were simply brigands and bandits. These diplomats and consuls would largely allow the CUP to carry out their revolution. By the middle of July, it had become clear to both the CUP and to the Sultan's government that the CUP had gained the upper hand, and that their gamble had paid off tremendously. Through the combination of months of CUP propaganda being spread throughout the European provinces of the empire, coupled with the decades of chaos and violence that had defined life for Ottomans in Macedonia and the surrounding provinces, the mutinies of Niazi and Enver had captured the public mood, and the CUP had launched the revolution at a moment when the general public was primed to fervently support their patriotic cause. The revolutionary officers of the Third Army had taken to the hills, and the CUP Fedayi had launched their assassination campaigns. And thereafter, a revolutionary wave had spread across the Balkans, and the Sultan had been completely unable to stop this wave, as administrators, governors, officers, soldiers, and town notables simply refused to carry out the Sultan's orders, or just as often, they would reveal that they were in fact already secret members of the CUP. As a result of this revolutionary wave, the imperial administration in Macedonia became completely paralyzed, and the CUP subsequently began to take over the governing of the European provinces of the empire. Unsurprisingly, perhaps, the revolutionary tipping point would come when the Sultan lost all control of the Albanian population of Ottoman Kosovo. As a complete matter of coincidence, an Austro-German school for railroad workers had planned a picnic just outside the city of Fierjovik in the southern part of Ottoman Kosovo. These Austro-German school teachers could not have chosen a worse time to plan an ostentatious picnic of foreigners in an Albanian town. At this very moment, CUP bands were taking control of the rural countryside of Kosovo and menacing the imperial administrators in the city. So, the public mood was fiery, to say the least. And even though the authorities would decide to cancel the picnic at the last minute, it was by that point too late, and rumors had begun to spread like wildfire that Austrian troops were gathering at the border and preparing to invade Ottoman Kosovo in order to annex the region. Now, there is no conclusive evidence that such rumors were the work of the CUP, but whether or not a CUP agent literally started these rumors, they certainly used their networks to help spread these rumors of an Austrian annexation. And one bit of context that we need to keep in mind here is that many, many Muslim Albanians who lived in Kosovo were Muhajir refugees who had fled Serbia in the aftermath of the Russian invasion of Ottoman Europe in 1877. When the Serbians had fought a simultaneous war against the Ottomans. In the aftermath of this Ottoman-Serbian war, the Serbians had initiated a ruthless campaign against the Muslim Albanians living in Serbia. And around 100,000 Muslims had either fled or been expelled from Serbia, and most of them found refuge in Ottoman Kosovo. Many thousands more would continue to flee into Kosovo in the years following. So, this is all to say that for the Muslim Albanians of Kosovo, the prospect of annexation into a Christian empire such as Austria-Hungary brought up nightmares of former atrocities and potential homelessness. So, with these rumors of an Austrian invasion swirling, thousands of Albanians began to gather in the city of Fircevik, and by July 19th, it is estimated that some 20,000 protesters had descended on the city, and this crowd began occupying government buildings, including the post office, where they started sending out telegrams to neighboring towns and villages calling on their fellow Albanians to join the movement. In response, the Sultan's top administrator selected a colonel who was the commander of the gendarme force in Skopje to investigate why tens of thousands of people were suddenly gathering in the city of Fircevik. And, well, you can probably guess what I'm about to say next. Yep, that's right. This colonel and gendarme commander was, in fact, a member of the executive committee of the CUP branch in Skopje. So, the CUP ordered this colonel to travel to Fircevik, specifically in order to further stir up this Albanian crowd, with the hopes of getting the Albanians to issue a besa, calling on the Sultan to reinstate the Mithat constitution. Now, I'm sure you are all asking, what in the heck is a besa? And I think I'm saying that right, by the way, but not totally sure. Let me know. But a besa is historically a very important aspect of Albanian tribal society and the cornerstone of Albanian customary law. A besa is, in short, a solemn oath or a pledge of honor. In the reigning Grand Vizier during this time in 1908, the Albanian Mehmed Ferid Pasha once described the Albanian besa as follows, quote, "An Albanian who says besa once cannot in any way break their promise and cannot be unfaithful to it." So, within Albanian culture, a besa is a super-duper big deal. And as a result of the encouragement of the gendarme commander and CUP agent who had been sent to control the situation, the Albanian leaders at the head of this mob would declare a besa, demanding the restoration of the Mithat constitution. And so, on July 20th, a telegram was sent to the Grand Vizier and to the head of the religious ulama scholars in Istanbul that was signed by nearly 200 Albanian notables, and this telegram asked for the reinstatement of constitutional rule. Shortly after this incident, which would come to be known as the Fircevik Gathering, the Sacred Committee of the CUP in Salonika under Talat sent out instructions to all branches of the CUP to begin making preparations for the final act of the revolution. CUP branch leaders were told to begin organizing military units and to begin preparing these units to march on the Ottoman capital in Istanbul. This assault on the imperial capital was scheduled for July 26th and would be undertaken if the Sultan's government continued to resist CUP demands. A day after this order was sent out, a joint force of CUP battalions under the leadership of Ahmed Niazi stormed the city of Monastir and kidnapped the imperial administrator who had been charged by the Sultan to restore order to the region. Then, the CUP began taking over all of the government buildings in Monastir, and they sent out declarations that anyone who disobeyed the orders of the CUP or stood against them in any way would be executed without hesitation. The CUP then used their access to the telegraph office in Monastir to contact all provincial governors that the constitution would be reinstated, whether the Sultan wanted it to be reinstated or not. Then the CUP sent out an ultimatum to the Sultan declaring that if he did not reinstate the constitution by July 6th, then the CUP battalions would march on the capital and depose him. On July 3rd, crowds began to gather in the towns, cities, and even the villages throughout Macedonia. And these crowds were treated to fiery speeches given by CUP agents, who declared that the crowds would not disperse until the constitution had been reinstated. With Macedonia now essentially under the complete control of the CUP, the Sultan knew that he needed to act fast if he was going to come out of this crisis with his reign as Sultan still intact. So, Abdulhamid dismissed his Grand Vizier, the Albanian conservative Mehmed Ferid, and appointed Said Pasha as the new Grand Vizier, with one of his ministers being Kamil Pasha, a known reformer who held sympathies with the opposition. Then, an emergency meeting was held at Yildiz Palace. During this meeting, a special commission waded through the ocean of telegrams that had flooded into the palace from the CUP branches throughout Macedonia. The new Grand Vizier then sent a telegram to the administrative hub in Monastir, informing them that this special commission was meeting in order to, quote, decide whether the reopening of the parliament in the midst of such political problems would be hazardous to the state or not. The CUP, who had by now taken over the government in Monastir, responded by saying that, quote, there was no need for a decision by a cabinet that never cares for the interests of the country and the rights of the people. They then redeclared their intention to march on the capital if the constitution was not reinstated by the July 26th deadline. At this point, the Sultan had played all of his cards, and there was really nothing left to do but to accept the fait accompli of the CUP. And so, much to the relief of the Sultan's closest advisors, at the conclusion of this emergency session, Abdulhamid declared that he would go with the current and that he would reinstate the constitution, making sure to remind everyone in the room that he had in fact been the one who had instituted the constitution in the first place, 30 years earlier at the very beginning of his reign. And on July the 24th, an imperial decree was published announcing the reinstatement of the Medhat constitution. And so the CUP had done it. The Young Turks had been pushing for the reinstatement of the Medhat constitution for decades now. And now they had finally achieved their number one goal. And for a brief period of time, the people of the Ottoman Empire would enjoy pretty widespread euphoria as they celebrated their new freedoms, as they welcomed home their family members who had been arrested or sent into exile, as they embraced their fellow citizens, their now equal Ottomans, and as they breathed a collective sigh of relief that they would no longer have to watch their backs and worry that everyone around them might be reporting them to the Sultan's secret police. And so, next week we will get to talk about something that is kind of rare on this podcast, good times in the Ottoman Empire, because a wave of optimism will sweep through the empire in the summer of 1908, as people begin to test their new rights as citizens to do things like speak openly in public and to protest and to unionize and to vote. So this moment of rare optimism in Ottoman lands would mark the beginning of what is often called the Second Constitutional Era. Like I said, I am going to take a break for a few weeks, but when we get back, we will make sure to make the most of this moment of euphoria in the Ottoman Empire as we begin the Ottoman Spring.